This is the week of August 14th and the music of Andre Lewis at AndreLewis.com. Hi, I'm Marlena, and you're listening to the Marlena Program, heard weekly at this time on ACB Radio Mainstream. For the next 2 hours, give or take, we'll be taking your phone calls at 866-666-7926. Love to hear your thoughts, your comments, your ideas, your suggestions, your opinions, whatever. Why don't you come on in, get comfy, spend some time with me, and give me a call, huh? Right here on Marlena. Welcome to another edition of the Marlena Program. Let me apologize in the very beginning for my scratchy voice. It's getting on toward fall, and asthma loves to join our family in this time of the year. So we will try to keep it as unscratchy and coughless as possible. But if you do hear a little throat clearing, that's what it's all about. I'm Marlena. We'll be with you for the next 2 hours. Let's get the housekeeping details out of the way first. If you are listening to this program at any time other than 9 to 10 Eastern, 6 to 7 Pacific in North America, or a very early 1 to 2 Universal on a Sunday night or Monday morning, it's a replay, and we want you to just sit back and enjoy. If you are listening live during those times, the telephone number to call is 866-666-7926. Let me tell you what's going to happen in the second hour, and then we're going to go to our guest in the first hour. As you know, we normally do open forum in our second hour, but this week we've changed the format a little bit, and we're going to meet Abdul Kamara, who has many fascinating things about which he can speak, but not the least of which is some strategies for us all to learn to advocate for an extremely important Senate bill that has major implications for those of us who are blind, dealing not only with video description, but equal access to voiceover internet protocol services. So I was quite taken with Abdul and have asked him to join us in the second hour. In the first hour, this is the one that you've all been waiting for. This is the show that when we needed to reschedule it, I was very, very gratified by the responses saying, please just let us know when this is going to be. We're going to talk about the life of Anne Sullivan Macy. And, you know, we all hear so much about Helen Keller, as we should. She was an amazing woman. But Anne Sullivan Macy was the genius who enabled the genius of Helen Keller. And to help us do that, help me make welcome Helen Selsden, who is with the American Foundation for the Blind. Helen, welcome to Marlena.
Thank you.
It's just great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Now, you are the archivist with AFB, is that right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit, before we get into talking about Anne, can you tell us a little bit about what we might find in the AFB archives? What are some of the things we can see there?
Sure. In 1968, Helen Keller bequeathed her collection to AFB, and we have over 280 manuscript boxes of her documents, her letters. And we have 60 boxes of photographs. We've got artifacts. We've got oversized material. We have a lot of material all about Helen. And I was brought to AFB to organize that material under a federal grant. And that's what I did about 2 or 3 years ago. And since then, we've had lots of, you know, and then I created the website about for kids on Helen Keller Kids Museum. And then that moved to me creating a website for Anne Sullivan Macy to tell her story.
Now, Can you tell us a little bit about the Helen Keller Kids Museum?
Sure. It's divided up into different sections about Helen's life, and it's just a very easy, it's approachable website, lots and lots of images for children to click onto, and it just goes through the different periods of her life. And I wanted to really to make it clear to children who think that Helen's life sort of was from birth to just childhood, that actually Helen went on to lead a very important life, was a very big advocate for the blind as an adult, and she traveled all over the world. And I want to make it clear to children how much she did as a grown-up and not just as a child. But I obviously did it in terms of that a child could understand.
Helen was an amazing person. I mean, I still learn more about her as time goes on. And, I mean, I just feel like she's someone I really would have liked. I mean, she seems to have been very involved in causes and women's issues. And is that an accurate perception?
Yeah, it really is. She was very, very politically engaged. She was into women's suffrage, and she corresponded with the leading women of her day. And also she corresponded with leading people throughout her life, and she lived from 1880 to 1968. So that's an incredible wide variety of people. She corresponded with Emma Goldman, the anarchist. She corresponded with Pearl S. Buck, with Margaret Sanger, with Eleanor Roosevelt, and the archives are full of these letters. It's a fabulous place. It really is. And I think she corresponded with about seven U.S. presidents, and we have correspondence from those people, too, as well as people like Mark Twain and Alexander Graham Bell. So, yeah, she really was amazing.
That is amazing. Now, I remember just after the horrific events of 9/11 that I remember seeing an article somewhere about some archives dealing with Helen that had been destroyed in New York.
In downtown, the Helen Keller International, Helen Keller International had materials, but they did not have, I don't believe, the documents and the major documents and major materials. They did lose materials, there's no question about it, but we were very lucky in the fact that we have the bulk of the materials. So it's not good, but it could have been way worse.
Yeah, well, that's I'm relieved to hear that because
many people ask me about that, and they had some materials, but not as many as people presumed. So the bulk of it is with us, and Perkins School for the Blind has wonderful archives that they're trying to organize, and there's material in Tuscumbia, Alabama, which was her home. So between all the different places, there's still quite a lot of material out there.
Are any of these materials somehow made accessible for blind visitors if they want to come and see the archives?
That's a good question, yeah. I often give tours, and I'm very keen on having sculptures touched and the descriptions below. Everything's braille, so even if things are behind cases, you can still, you know, if you can't see, you can absolutely understand what is in the case. And I'm always very, I give personal tours, so I make sure that everybody can see and really understand what's there.
Well, I tell you, the next time I come to New York, I'm going to call you.
I love doing it.
Oh, I mean, I would love to meet you, but
one of the great things that people love is she got an Oscar in 1955, which is extraordinary because I don't know many people who got an Oscar not for their own work. She got an Oscar as an inspiration for the movie Helen Keller and Her Story, for the documentary about her. And so often I get that out, and people get very excited. They like to hold the Oscar. It's very sweet.
Well, it's probably for many of us the one and only time we'd ever see an Oscar.
I know, and that's what people say.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, that's kind of neat. All right, we're going to open the phone lines in just a bit here, but let's talk about her teacher, the woman who really enabled and taught and developed Helen Keller. Now, the image that I have of Anne is the Anne Bancroft image in The Miracle Worker.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when I listened, and we do have a clip that we're going to play here in a bit, but when I listened to the real Anne's actual voice, I had to draw a whole new picture of her.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about Anne.
Well, Anne was born to Irish immigrants in Massachusetts, and she grew up in extreme poverty. Her father was an alcoholic, and her mother died when she was very young, and she and her brother were sent to a place called the Tewkesbury Almshouse, which was infamous in its day, for being just an awful place where people were just treated very badly within the almshouse. And her brother died 3 months after their arrival. She saw her brother, you know, laid out in front of her. And she was at Perkins for many years. And then at one point, there was a someone from the Perkins School for the Blind was visiting. An official came from Perkins to Tewkesbury because it was becoming very well known as a, you know, sort of infamous place. And at which point, Anne sort of screamed out, "Please, you know, I can't see. I want to go to school." And she managed to get herself pulled out of Perkins and pulled out of Tewkesbury and went to Perkins. After many years, she was became valedictorian of her class. She was brilliant. She was a very, very feisty lady. She was very sassy. She wasn't an easy person to get on with, but I think that really stood her in good stead. And ultimately, she became the star of her class, and then the head of Perkins, who was called Michael Anagnos, ended up sending her to the Keller family in 1886, and I think the rest is sort of famous. But what I do want to stress about Anne is that people forget that she was legally blind from the age of 7 to 15. We always focus on Helen. What was so interesting for me when I started to write the website for Anne Sullivan Macy is how I had to rethink everything to do with Anne, because I was so used to seeing Anne from Helen's perspective. Even a sentence, I would start with Helen in my thoughts instead of Anne. And by sort of turning it around, it really helped me understand Anne. So what I did in this website was to really tell the story from her perspective. As much as possible, I quote her. I quote people describing her. Can I describe the website to you?
Yes, please.
Okay. It's a multimedia website, and it has photographs and speeches and newspaper cartoons and comic strips, and it's got the audio. And I really wanted to give sort of the feeling of this brilliant, feisty lady, but who was also, you know, suffered from her own. She really was very, very anxious and very, she had, you know, loads of issues from when she was a child, which isn't surprising. She had issues, I think, that were much harder in some ways to overcome than even Helen's issues, which sounds extraordinary, but she really did have a whole different set of social problems to overcome. But Helen, who came from a comfortable southern middle to upper middle class family, you know, it was very hard, obviously, being deafblind. There's no way, you know, it obviously was. But it was still a different set of issues. And I think in some ways Anne found it harder to surmount her own personal problems than Helen did. Helen was very strongly also religious. She was a Swedenborgian. And Anne absolutely was raised in Catholicism, but absolutely totally had disdain for religion and anything that was sort of smacked of conformity. So I want people to really realize that it was very tough for Anne. She could not see from the age of 7 to 15, and then she finally got, after many botched operations, she got a decent operation, two decent operations, which restored her sight, although it was still not very good for the rest of her life. And also, the biggest thing about Anne is that she was a pioneer in education, and I really want to stress that in the website. She had an impact on education that I think impacted today, not just for blind kids, but for sighted kids today. She taught Helen outdoors. It was a very sort of sensory, it wasn't just by rote. She wasn't just sitting in front of her, you know, at a desk. She really made Helen understand the world around her, which is why I think she managed to communicate with Helen and she could teach her. So those are the things that I really want to communicate about the website.
Well, and it's interesting that you should say that, because I, and caller, if you will hold on, we'll get right to you. I had a teacher who was, as I read more about Anne in my adult life and from your wonderful website, I really realize how much of an impact Anne must have had on my teacher, whose name was also Anne, ironically enough. And mm-hmm. my teacher would, she had five blind students in a public school, and she would take us outside, and we would be getting on fire engines and climbing over things and playing kickball and with sighted children. You know, she
absolutely was like this. And she got an award at the same time as Maria Montessori got an award in 1915. And Maria, I quote Maria in the website, sort of tips her hat to Anne's expertise as a natural teacher, because she really wasn't, I mean, she was taught to be a teacher, but she had this natural genius for it. When you described Anne as a genius, I thought that was spot on. I believe she really was a genius. I thought it was an amazing lady. Can I also quote one thing, that there's one quotation.
Yes, please.
Explain Anne and her philosophy about education. She writes, "Our schools uproot the creative ideals of childhood and plant in their place worthless ideals of ownership. The fine soul of the child is of far greater importance than high marks, yet the system causes the pupil to prize high grades above knowledge, and he goes from the schools into his life work believing always that the score is more important than the game, possession more praiseworthy than achievements." And I think you could say that it was sort of so apposite. It's just as relevant today as it was then.
Boy,
it was amazingly spot on.
I think in many ways, if it could possibly be more relevant today.
Yeah.
You know, here in Washington, we're fighting over the creation of tests that everyone must pass or else they can't. Oh my gosh, education is becoming a cookie cutter. And let's bring our caller in. Hello there, you're with Helen Selsden and Marlena. Who's this?
Hi, Marlena, it's Judy from Austin.
Hi, Judy.
I'm calling to ask a question. I did some work on Helen Keller in graduate school. And in Nella Brady's biography of Anne Sullivan, and also in the Lash book, it's just briefly mentioned that when James and Annie were sent to Tewksbury, another Sullivan child was sent to relatives. In adulthood, did Annie have any contact with the Sullivan family? And also, do you know what happened to that child?
Right. The child, I think, was Mary. And I don't know what happened to that child, but I do believe she went off with another family member, and that Anne might have gotten in contact with her, but I'm not sure. I can't really answer that question properly. But basically, there was no real contact with that other child, as far as I know.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Judy. Let's move to the audio clip that AFB so generously provided to me. I found this extremely moving.
Yeah,
and since we're talking about Anne as a teacher, I think this might be the right time to play it. So if the computer will cooperate, the next voice you will hear will be that of Anne Sullivan Macy.
When I saw Helen Keller first, she was 6 years and 8 months old. She had been blind and deaf and mute since her 19th month as the result of an illness. She had no way of communicating with those around her except a few imitative signs that she had made for herself. A push man's go and a pull man's come and so on. She had observed that we did not use the hands when we were talking to each other. And I let her see by putting her hand on my face how we talked with our mouths. She felt the vibration of the spoken word. Instantly, she spelled, "I want to talk with my mouth." That seemed impossible. But after experimenting for a time, we found that placing her hand in this position, the thumb resting on the throat, right at the larynx, the first finger on the lips, the second on the nose, we found that she could feel the vibration of spoken words. For instance, the throat, she feels the G, the hard G, G. And on the lips, she feels the K sound. On the lips, she feels the B. And the K. And the, with the second finger on the nose, the nasal sounds, the N. The N. The first word she learned to articulate was the little word it. With the hand in this position, I made the vowel I. She felt it. I. Then I made the T. She feels it with the finger on her lip. On my lips. Then I put the two letters together to form the word it. And the first word was learned. After her seventh lesson, she was able to speak the sentence word by word. I am not dumb now.
No.
That to me is an extremely moving clip.
Extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
It's just. Yeah. And you can hear the pride mm-hmm. in Anne's voice when she yeah. says, and the
Absolutely.
First word was learned.
Mm-hmm.
We have another caller. Let's bring them on in. Hi there, you're with Helen Selsden and Marlena. Who is this? Hello?
Hi, Marlena. This is Pam.
Hi, Pam.
I had my phone on mute so that I could hear what was being said.
Oh, that's okay. Meet Helen Selsden.
I wanted to let you know that I have something, and certainly this would apply to anybody if anyone has such. I have a Braille book, which I am sure is authentic. I found it in a bunch of old books that had been donated to an organization that I was somewhat involved with several years ago. And they really had no idea what they had, I'm sure of it, or else it wouldn't be sitting in this moldy library, which is why I took it home. But what it is it's Helen Keller's journal, 1936 to 37, written shortly mm-hmm. after the passing of Anne Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
And on the fly leaves of the first of all three volumes, I was reading this book, and all of a sudden I noticed what looked like slate markings. So I opened it, and the fly leaf, it says, to Nina Rhodes, whose dear hands will hear more in these pages, in this book, than meets the ear. And it is affectionately Helen Keller, Newmarket, New Hampshire, Christmas
mm-hmm. 1938. Wow.
That's fabulous.
And I really would like to, and it's, mm-hmm. There were a couple of slit marks in the binding. Okay, I took it, but I didn't feel any compunction about taking it because the people that had this just said, oh, go on, read this. You know, they had no idea what they had.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to turn it over to the library, and I wonder how I would go about doing that.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
that would be
Pam.
Fantastic.
To be honest with you, I haven't fully
wonderful.
Read it. Haven't completely read it, and I was looking. The background of it is this was shortly after Anne's death. It was determined that
right.
Anne and, or that mm-hmm. Helen and Polly should take a European tour to kind of
right. We have the book, but I've never seen a Braille edition of it.
You have not.
So that would be absolutely
book.
Fantastic.
Oh, I would be glad. In fact, the binding is a little sad, and I was thinking, Pam, you better get this finished. And
oh, I wouldn't. I'd leave it the way it is.
No, you
oh,
can.
No,
oh,
no, but I'm saying I
is...
need to finish reading it.
Oh.
I'm that selfish. I am, dear. But no,
you spell Rhodes, R-H-O-A-D-E-S, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, because I know I do know this lady, and I can't remember why I know her, but I know she corresponded with Helen.
There is also a one of the pages. There's an asterisk at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and I turned to the footnote, and I believe one of her relatives was a banker or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they evidently, yeah. And she did mention her in the book as being one of her schoolmates.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe she went to Radcliffe.
Yeah.
This is fantastic. Thank you so much.
Want me to contact you off the air, if you want to tell me where to send this, whenever, wherever, I'd be glad to, because that was my real intention in taking it.
So maybe, Marlena, you could help me figure that out once
I will. Pam, I will put you in touch with Helen.
Absolutely. I really want to do this.
Oh, you know.
Oh, that's wonderful.
What great listeners we have here on ACB Radio. I tell you what.
This was pure luck, and I've had it for a while.
Wow.
And I'm just like, one of these days I'm going to do that. And here came the opportunity right here.
Oh, it's fantastic.
And you know what, Pam? I appreciate that you didn't tell me in advance because that's that. It just, oh, what a great surprise.
That is.
That's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
That's just wonderful.
I just somehow thought you might like to have it.
Well,
thank you, it belonged in the archive. I don't need it in my bookshelf.
Yeah, exactly.
We will take very good care of it. Believe me, we have a climate-controlled environment. We have beautiful movable stacks. That was what we had to do to, you know, when we got the federal funding. So everything is up to archival standards. So it will be well
wonderful,
taken care of.
This has been, you know, through a few moves, and it was not very well
absolutely.
Cared for in the beginning.
Yep.
So Pam, just kind of a blind nerdy question. The slate marks, are they like board slate, do you think, or are they?
I think they are. I think they're little pin pricks, and they do go all the way down. I think they were board slate. Wait a minute, what's this? I was halfway through the volume one. And I happened to open the book, and my hand just somehow landed at the right spot. And wait a minute, there's something. I felt the indentations on the front. The inscription is in the back of the page. Mm-hmm. And I felt something was not entirely smooth on the front. Mm-hmm. So I reached forward, reached left, and there were the holes.
Wow.
Yeah, so I opened it and
fabulous.
I went, wow.
Boy, you know, it would be interesting to try to replicate. It would be interesting to try to replicate the slate that she might have used at that time as well.
We have the letters that she wrote as a very young child, one of the early, in fact, I think it's on the Helen Keller Kids Museum website. A sample of words that she wrote when she was six, and they are so beautifully written. They're in pencil. They're this square script, and they have a sort of I think she used a ruler underneath when she wrote, and you can actually even see pinpricks even when she wrote, you know, when she was trying to write.
Yeah,
you can see the way she tried to do it, and her writing was amazing. It was absolutely extraordinary. There are many little children who are 10 and 11 who, you know, who have their sight and, you know, as well as their hearing and their calligraphy is not as good as hers was.
I was fascinated about that. My sweetheart Dave is here on the line, and I know he wants to say something pertaining to this.
Well, all I want to say is I think it ought to be, one of you guys ought to go either he ought to come out here or you ought to go back there. I do not think this would be something I would trust to the mail or UPS or FedEx or anything.
Right.
Because especially if you think this is the only copy in existence, I think that would be something that really needs to be
personal
thought about.
Mm-hmm. We'll
figure it out.
Yeah,
we'll let
AFB get that worked out. Yeah, that's a great idea. Great idea.
Yeah.
Well, Pam, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm glad. I was afraid we might not be home in time from another event that we went to, but I'm so glad we were.
Well, and thank you again for not giving it away to me earlier. This means a lot to me.
Yeah, I would have emailed you if I hadn't made it here, but here I'm glad I was able to speak directly with Helen herself.
All right. Thanks,
thank
Pam.
Thank you so much. I'm Helen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
866-666-7926. We'll be with Helen Selsden for about another half hour, and then we will be meeting Abdul Kamara, who is an extremely fascinating individual and is going to talk with us about S2686. Helen, we have another call. Shall we bring them on in? Hi there. You're with Helen Selsden and Marlena. Who's this?
This is Kelly Superja from Saskatchewan, Canada.
Kelly Superja from Saskatchewan. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Meet Helen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First, I just wanted to say that was a great clip.
Wasn't that incredible?
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's I treasure that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's one reason I'm calling in is about the miracle worker. I've got the movie, and I've watched it, you know, lots of times. And we actually studied the play when I was in high school. What I was wondering about was when I think his name was William Gibson when he
Gibson.
Wrote
mm-hmm.
when he wrote the play. Yeah. Did he somehow get a hold of Helen Keller herself and get all get all the information for the play, or how did that all come about? I wonder.
I believe he did. I'm not 100% positive, but I'm fairly sure that he did. I can't give you too many details, but if you like, I'm very happy to go and look into it and somehow get some answers back to you, if that helps at all. Because I could do that.
Okay.
I know that Helen met with I think it was with Anne Bancroft. I'm not sure. You know, let me double check. I'm not 100% sure on this. I think he met with Helen, but I'm not positive.
Well, and if you want to let me know, Helen, then I can announce it back here.
Sure.
As well. We also have a Friends of ACB Radio email list, and I can post it there as well. So, but, you know, one question that I had, thank you, Kelly, for bringing up the miracle worker, because the question that I had, when I listened to that clip, I was surprised because, from anything that I had ever learned, the first word that she articulated was water. And,
Anne says it.
And Anne says it. So which one's true? I suppose Anne would know, huh?
Right. I guess Anne would know, but also I think what the time at the pump did, you know, when the water came gushing out of the pump.
Yes.
And I think Helen was 18 months when she went deaf and blind, and I've read text to show that she said she has vague memories of the word wah for water. I think she remembers it, but I think the first word probably was it, because I'm sure Anne was right, but there were sort of memories of words that Helen would have retained when she was a tiny infant. But I'm sure Anne was right, because she was just super smart. She wouldn't have gotten
it
wrong.
Yeah, yeah. It was just a surprise to me to hear that it was it. But, you know, and also I guess water at the pump was more dramatic for the movie than it.
That's very true. But I have to say, you know, to do the movie justice, I thought they took some things straight from the story of my life, you know, Helen's autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as much as it was a dramatization, I think it was a very good dramatization, actually.
It was.
I really do. I think it's a very, very good movie.
Yeah.
I think it sort of conveys the feeling and everything. And I think what's another very interesting thing is in the movie you see Anne wearing glasses. In many, many images that I've have in the archive of Anne and Helen and Anne alone, she is never wearing glasses. And I think that's a very interesting, maybe she was told to remove the glasses, because at that time it wasn't, you know, because they were cloudy glasses, you know, black cloudy glasses.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the depiction of Anne in The Miracle Worker, I think, was actually a good stab at trying to be fairly accurate and true to it, but also trying to keep the, you know, audience riveted, which I'm totally riveted when I watched that movie.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Kelly, anything else?
No, that was basically about it. Although
I'll try and get back to you with
also wondering what if you know, Helen had any thoughts on, you know, the movie itself, or the play at least.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's really good. I really do. I think it's a really good effort at showing, and also the text, some of the actual lines, because I've read the letters so often from the story of my life. I know the actual lines were totally, you know, they were taken from Anne Sullivan's Sullivan Macy's letters to Michael Anagnos, who was the director of Perkins, because that's how we know what happened, because Anne had to write back to her former boss and say and describe the progress with Helen. And in the movie, they really do, they're true to those words. So I think it's quite good.
All right. Thanks, Kelly.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
866-666-7926. Anne moved on through her life, and she met, boy, our telephone, and we have lots of people who want to talk with you. If you'll just hold on a moment, caller.
Sure.
She met, John Macy. Where did she meet John Macy?
At Radcliffe, when Helen was at university.
And John was a young Harvard teacher, and he was an editor at the Youth Companion. And John was a major, major person in Anne's life. Although their marriage didn't last, I think she loved him deeply, and I think it was just too difficult a situation with the three of them all together, ultimately. It was just too much, and she was just too much of a firebrand for the marriage to really make it through. And I do write about that in the website, and I also put up some love letters, a couple of love letters that Anne wrote to John, and they are absolutely beautiful. People don't realize that she was, because we all read Helen's work, we don't read Anne's work. And Anne was a beautiful writer. She wrote so beautifully. And I'd love people to go and, you know, see and read her, how she describes things. Especially one of my favorite things is when she was in Puerto Rico, one of the rare occasions, probably the only occasion when she was without Helen, is when she was convalescing. She went to Puerto Rico in 1916, and she writes letters back from Puerto Rico describing the island. I mean, I'm happy to read some one out, or
sure.
Can I do that? Or,
sure.
Yeah? She writes, "You know, Helen, dear, Socrates believed in the existence of the Fortunate Isles, somewhere beyond the blue zenith of our sky, isles which those who have lived in beauty sail to after death. Well, I found one of the Fortunate Isles while still alive. Here I find freedom from the vexations of wars and politics and duties that have never interested me. This is the realm of warm delight." And she goes on, "I'm glad I didn't inherit the New England conscience. If I did, I should be worrying about the state of sin I am now enjoying in Puerto Rico. One can't help being happy here. Helen, happy and idle and aimless and pagan, all the sins we are warned against. I go to bed every night soaked with sunshine and orange blossoms and fall asleep to the soporific sound of oxen munching banana leaves." I think it's beautiful.
That is beautiful.
And she really could write.
Let's bring in our next caller. Hello there. You're with Helen Selsden and Marlena. Who's this? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
This is Sharon Huey from Maryland.
Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the Marlena Show.
Hi. Had a quick question. Where is the website, or can we get to those websites? Anne Sullivan Mason,
absolutely.
And Helen Keller? And I'll hang up now.
Okay, great. Thanks, Sharon. Go ahead, Helen.
Yeah, it's www.afb, for American Foundation for the Blind, .org/Anne Sullivan. But you can go to AFB's website as a whole, but it is very easy to get from afb.org to the Helen Keller Kids Museum, to the Braille Bug, to everything that AFB does, as well as the Anne Sullivan Macy Museum.
And we have another caller. We'll bring this caller in. Hi there. You're with Helen Selsden and Marlena. Who's this?
Hello, this is Margaret Johnson from Arkansas.
Hello, Margaret.
And I enjoyed the book, Helen and Teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's a fabulous book.
I went to the Helen Keller Conference in 1980, and mm-hmm. I just thought it was one of the best conferences for the blind. It was the only one I'd ever been to, but still, since then, I've never enjoyed anything any better than that. But, I read that book, and I kind of thought that when Helen was going around learning a name for everything, mm-hmm. I thought that's when she learned water, and I thought that later, when Alexander Graham Bell came into it, well, then that's when they started trying to teach her to speak, and I thought that was kind of a later thing, so maybe this word "it" was, you know, when it was time to speak, but she tried to say water, that's true, but it was, I think she had a time where she was going around, you know, learning a name for everything, and she was spelling words. And
that's a good point, but when she actually learned actually how to pronounce words properly, that might have been the first actual word she learned to speak. Is that what you're saying? As opposed to just knowing words and understanding them.
Yeah. She really knew what she was doing when she saw water.
That's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that was a really good book. Did Anne Sullivan actually have a college degree?
Nope. Mm-mm.
I didn't know.
She did not. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
She did not.
Yeah.
Huh. And then one other thing that I was thinking about was, at one time in the Helen and Teacher, they talked about how Helen had a boyfriend that she liked.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne broke it up.
Actually.
Actually, I think it's Helen's mother that broke it up. People often ask me this question. The gentleman was Peter Fagan, and she had an affair with Peter, and they wanted to elope, but the mother forbade it. My sense is that she didn't think that a woman who was blind and deaf should necessarily go off and have children, actually. I think she was, whereas Anne would not. This is very sort of a personal opinion as much as anything else. I don't know if it's even AFB's thing, but I really think from everything I've read that Anne truly promoted Helen's own love of life and she wanted her to live life to the full. And many people say, was she her own person? This is the big question that people ask me. Was Helen her own person, or was she a mouthpiece of Anne Sullivan Macy? I truly believe that because Anne did such a good job of teaching her and teaching her to think for herself, that Helen really was her own person, and Anne would not have stopped a love affair with Peter.
Well,
Fagan.
I didn't get that idea from the Helen and teacher, did you?
Mm-hmm. I know. Well, I have a different opinion.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly I'm no expert on Anne, but just, you know, from what I've read about her, and even from the last bit that you read from her letter from Puerto Rico, this sounds like a woman who is so supportive of you are a whole person, get out there,
absolutely,
live your life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, Margaret, we got to run because we're getting a lot of calls.
Wanted to add that because that is a really thorough book, and of course,
it's a fantastic book. It's a really, really wonderful book.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, I'm going to run the show and talk to you later, Marlena.
All right, thanks, Margaret.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Go ahead, Helen. Did you want to say?
I don't think Lash necessarily says that Anne stopped the relationship. I think actually, I'm not sure he really says that. I'll go and read my Lash book again, but I really I don't get that sense that he would say something like that, given that he understood that Anne really promoted Helen, wanted Helen to have her own thoughts. I mean, she certainly, Anne and Helen had completely different religious, you know, thoughts, and in some ways many very different philosophical thoughts. They were both socialists, but Anne absolutely did not act on it, and Helen definitely did. Helen was very, she wasn't passive at all in her politics. Whereas Anne was not like that. Anne thought religion just didn't work for her, but it was Helen was profoundly, deeply Christian. In fact, a quote that I have on the website sort of tries to show that Anne understood that religion was an important part for Helen, and that in some ways she was sorry that she couldn't be comforted by religion in a way that Helen could be. So,
did Anne and Helen ever have any major disagreement between them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know from the record, and I don't want to say, I mean, I'd like to say I do know, but I don't.
Yeah.
They must have done. They had to. I mean, there's no way they couldn't have done, but I think the overriding need of one for the other sort of maybe just took precedent. I'm sure when Anne went to Puerto Rico and she was finally sort of, you know, free of, in a way, of Helen, she says this is, it was liberating. And I'm sure if you find something that liberating, you could also think what's trapping you. And
sure,
in some ways, Helen's life, you know, she was totally, it was her life. But at the end of her life, people ask her, would she have done differently? Would she have ever left Helen? And she says, I don't know that I would have done, actually. That we don't. And also, she was very much a fatalist, unlike Helen. And I just don't think she could have done. I don't think it was. She didn't have the strength to do it. I don't know.
I want to. We have another call. I'm going to bring them in a minute here, and then I want to talk about Polly and when Polly came into Anne and Helen's life. But let's bring in our caller. Hello there. You're with Helen Selston and Marlena. Who's this?
Hello there, this is Timothy from Halifax.
Hello, Timothy from Halifax. You need to speak up. We can hardly hear you.
I'm on a cordless.
Okay, go ahead.
I've listened to the Helen story back in, I don't know, about 80-something when I was a Sir Frederick Fraser.
Uh-huh.
And I've never really gotten the full story because we only had a small bit of the story in audio format. Are there any more bigger, more of the unabridged version?
Of which?
Of the audio of the Helen and or the Ann Sullivan, Macy.
Do you mean the clip? Because that we only have that small clip.
No, the audio book themselves. Are there...
Of which book, though? Do you mean the story of my life or which book?
Any of them.
Well, now, I don't know. I'm sure that in your Canadian library system that you can get the story of my life and Helen and Teacher at a minimum. Mm-hmm. I would be very surprised if those books weren't available.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
It does, yeah.
Okay.
I just want to find out if I can get the unabridged version because I've heard of the abridged versions and... The abridged versions didn't give the whole.
Well, I would check with my talking book library up there,
mm-hmm.
and you know if they don't have it, then let me know and I'll see if I can help you find something in audio.
Well, I can go through IRL as well.
Yeah.
Interlibrary loan. So.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
All right then.
All right. Thanks, Timothy.
Bye now.
Bye bye. What about Polly? Who was uh-huh. she? How did she come on the scene and when?
Yep. She was a Scottish lady. She arrived as John left. She arrived as a secretary, and she became increasingly important, especially because of Anne's failing health. So the less that Anne was physically able to do, the more Polly did. She learned to manually sign. So she became increasingly important. She traveled all over the world with Helen once Anne died, because they traveled, you know, far and wide. And the thing is, Polly doesn't get much of a look in, I'm afraid. She really doesn't. And even in Anne and Helen, she doesn't, in Lash's book, she obviously doesn't. But she really seems to be a bit of a sub-figure. I think because because she wasn't as sort of intellectually, dynamic as Anne was. She was a solid, you know, reliable lady who was really essential to Helen navigating from one, you know, tour and country to the next, but she didn't necessarily provide that intellectual stimulation that Anne had done, and I think it was a very different kind of companionship.
So she really was more a companion,
yes.
perhaps, than a teacher mm-hmm. or enabler.
Absolutely.
For Helen.
That's the way I see it, absolutely.
866-666-7926. We'll have Helen Selsden with us for about 10 more minutes. And once again, if you're listening at any time other than 9 to 10 Eastern, 6 to 7 Pacific on a Sunday night in North America, 1 to 2 on an early universal morning on Monday, this is a repeat, so please just enjoy. Helen, if people would like to get hold of you, can they
mm-hmm.
email you?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And how would they do that?
I can give you my email address. Can I do that?
Sure, that's great.
I'm fine with doing that. hselsden@afb.net. That's H and Selsden, S-E-L-S-D-O-N, @afb.net.
And once again, give the website address.
Sure. www.afb.org and for Anne Sullivan Macy /Anne Sullivan.
And Anne is A-N-N-E?
And A-N-N-E, right.
Yeah.
And then S-U-L-L-I-V-A-N.
Now, mm-hmm. we talked a little bit about Anne and John and mm-hmm. that the marriage did not last.
Mm-hmm.
For how
yeah.
long did that marriage last?
They got married in 1905, and it sort of dissolved 1913, 1914. So my math isn't that good, but not so long.
8 or 9 years.
And, you know, he was 11 years younger than her, and she expected to way outlive him. She expected that he would way outlive her, and he died at the age of 55.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she died 4 years later. It was very sad. It really was.
Let's mm-hmm. let's bring our next caller in. Hi there. You're with Helen Selsden and Marlena. Who's this?
Hi, it's Debbie Hazelton.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
To be here.
I know Helen lived at one point in Westport, Connecticut, and mm-hmm. I lived very close to that when I was growing up. I didn't get to ever meet her. I did hear her in a recording once say, "I am not dumb now."
Right. That was the clip we just played.
Yeah, I didn't get to hear that when I mm-hmm. at the beginning. But, mm-hmm. It would have been wonderful to have been able to meet her.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I heard one time that she invented the talking book machine.
No, she didn't. But AFB was instrumental in creating the talking book machine. In the late 20s, early 30s, really the early 30s, it became a WPA, Works Progress Administration project, and the government paid the Library of Congress, and the Library of Congress hired AFB to help develop the talking book. And Helen wrote to FDR, Roosevelt, lobbying for money and for appropriations
okay.
for the talking book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So AFB was absolutely key, and so was Helen. Helen was very important in the talking book coming about, but she didn't, per se invent
okay.
it. But she was very important in making it, in bringing the money in, which was absolutely key. She was a huge
mm-hmm.
money fundraiser.
Mm, wonderful.
And Helen mm-hmm. Keller was also a musician, was she not?
No, I've never heard that one before.
I'm sure that I read somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, maybe I made it up. I don't know, but
maybe I just don't know.
I am sure I read somewhere that she learned to play the piano.
Well, I've never heard that one. I know that Anne was actually quite good at music, and she was also very good at sculpting. She was very artistic, but Helen listened with her, through the vibrations to a lot
right.
of music.
Yeah,
she was
yeah.
a huge music fan. Which sounds strange, but it isn't. She really, she would stand next to an opera singer and she would touch, she was very famous opera singers, and she would feel their mouths, and she would
Aww.
Feel, she would stand next to violinists and she would get the vibrations. She listened to music, she really did. And I know she loved music, but I've never heard of her playing an instrument, although I'm fairly sure that Anne was pretty talented at music.
Well, maybe that's where my confusion is.
Hmm. Uh-huh. Maybe. Mm-hmm.
All right,
but
Debbie.
Was Anne fully sighted, or was she? She was.
She had low vision all her life,
okay.
and she was legally blind from the age of 7 to 15.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she really. It was not easy for Anne at all. And also, remember, she had to read all these texts when Helen was not only a student but later in life, and so her eyes suffered because she wore them out.
Mm.
She really did, trying to read to Helen when she herself couldn't see very well.
Do we know what her eye condition was?
Trachoma.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. She suffered from trachoma, and it wasn't properly taken care of when she was a little girl. And and also, I'm sure botched operations to one's eyes doesn't help. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And she had many botched operations, especially in Tewkesbury. She was sent from Tewkesbury to some local hospitals, and they messed things up. It was only when she went to Perkins that she was successfully operated on.
All right,
yeah.
Debbie. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
We have time for one more call, I think, for Helen Selsden at 866-666-7926, and here it is. Hi there, you're with Helen Selsden and Marlena. Who's this?
Hi, it's Sue Amateur.
Hi, Sue.
Let me turn my radio down, sorry.
Yes.
I just had a little anecdotal story to tell. I don't know whether, Helen, you had ever heard this, but
mm-hmm.
here in the state of Washington, we had one of the first human rights commissions that started in 1949, and our director had two deaf-blind children. And Helen Keller came out here, I think it was on the train, it's been a while since I read his book, and came out here and helped the director, his name is Glenn Mansfield, figure out a way to provide education for his two little deaf-blind children. His wife died, and he raised five children on his own, like I say, two of whom were deaf-blind.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Helen got off the train, according to Glenn, she wanted to feel his face, and she said,
mm-hmm.
"You feel like you're a good man."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally Helen.
Yeah, anyway,
that's totally Helen. Yeah, that's completely Helen. And I have stories that I know are accurate, that she shakes hands with somebody that she hasn't met in 20 years, and she literally names who that person is.
Wow.
She remembers. She has such staggering sensory abilities that she remembers through a handshake.
Can I tell one other sort of anecdotal story? It's fantastic.
Yes, please.
There's a there's something called the I think it's the Alibaba Club. It's of specialists in Oriental tapestries in New York City, and they did a competition. They had the specialists feel these Oriental rugs and see if they could remember them. They wanted to see if how much they could identify these rugs and have Helen also do it. But, of course, the thing was they would feel the rugs for half an hour. Helen would be given a certain amount of time and describe these rugs to feel the rugs. And then these people would be, specialists would be blindfolded. And then they would have to go back and identify each of the different kind of rugs by the feel of the rug. So they did this competition, and lo and behold, the only person who could identify 20 rugs correctly was Helen.
Wow.
By touch alone.
Wow.
It's absolutely, and that's a totally accurate story. I mean, that's a totally, I've got the documentation for that. It's extraordinary. She was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah. I missed part of the show, so if you covered this, I'll listen again. Did we lose part of the museum in the World, wasn't it in the World Trade Center?
Right. It was, we didn't. We lost some materials. I mean, we absolutely did, but we did not lose the bulk of the collection. The bulk of the collection is, I'm happy to say, at AFB, and also said the Perkins School for the Blind has materials, and Tuscumbia, Alabama, her Helen's hometown, have materials too. So we did lose materials, as far as I know, they weren't absolutely, there wasn't a huge collection at all. And they weren't key materials.
That was
not good, but it was way,
right,
it could have been a lot worse.
And what was the year of Helen's death?
What was the what, sorry?
What was her,
1968. Yeah.
She was born, was it 1887?
1880. Yeah.
Extreme. Interestingly enough, her birthday is the same day as my grandma's.
There you go.
Really?
So.
Wow.
Anyway, good show, but I just wanted to share that anecdote because it was just terrific.
No, it's fantastic, and it's very Helen. It's completely on the,
you know, and to come all the way out here on the train in 19, I think it was in the 50s, was a long trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, thanks so much, Helen and Marlena.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
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 As we wrap up, Helen, talk to me about, and I hope I'm not putting you on the spot here, but I read on the website just before Anne died, very
mm-hmm.
close to her death. She
mm-hmm.
actually spoke of her love for John.
Yeah.
Can you
mm-hmm.
talk about that a little? Because I don't want to leave people with the impression that Anne was all Helen and it was Helen's issue that it didn't work out. And
No, not at all. And Anne was a complicated lady herself. Because, I mean, it was, and actually, you know what I would like to do, if you give me 1 second, to go to this place. Where it describes on the website how, you know, teacher just couldn't, you know, it was more than, it's not a simple problem at all. Hold on 1 second, let me see if I can find exactly where it is.
And as Helen is looking this up, I really encourage folks to visit the website afb.net/Anne Sullivan. You know, we all think we know the story. We've all been told, those of us who are blind, you know, from being little blind kids all our lives, we've heard the story, but we haven't heard the story of Anne, and we haven't heard the
mm-hmm.
story as Anne
mm-hmm.
lived it. And that's what I think you bring to life here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, that's exactly what I've tried to do. This is what Helen writes. I am haunted by a perception that Annie never wholly acquiesced in the fact of her marriage. She gained greater self-control. She held her darker moods well in hand like an animal trainer. But now and then she could hear them growling, and she said she needed me to keep her quiet and reasonable. I think she had so many issues of her own. It wasn't that Helen just dominated her teacher. That just doesn't ring true to me. I think that just would be too simple an answer. I think it is way more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Can I also say that it's important to know that the website is fully accessible.
Yes, indeed it is.
For blind and visually impaired people.
Yes.
It's completely fully accessible. So I don't want anyone to think it's just this, you know, it's absolutely for everybody. So whether you can see or not, or you can hear or not, you can absolutely use it. And I think that's important. And I think above all, Anne and Helen would have been thrilled. Anne as a teacher would have been thrilled with the website. That's what gave me personal pride in sort of like, you know, Helen and Anne gets her day in the sun, because this is exactly what she tried to do. She tried to educate everybody, and the way to do it is to give knowledge. And modern technology can do that, especially for the blind and visually impaired. And I think the website, I hope, does that, that it shows what one can do and how one can forge ahead, even with the greatest obstacles. So I that's really what I wanted to do with the website.
Well, Helen, I thank you so much for joining us. And
my pleasure.
And we would love to have you back again.
Absolutely.
And we can talk more about Helen and Anne. But and on behalf of people who are blind and people who are learning, thank you so much for putting together what you've put together. It's,
my pleasure.
It's a masterpiece. And,
it was a privilege, actually.
We'll look forward to having you join us again.
Sure.
Thank you,
Marlena.
Helen.
Bye-bye.
Stay with us.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the sun in the sky. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the clouds so high. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the whispering wind. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the birds in spring. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the moonlit night. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the stars so bright. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the wonder in me. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the way I feel. Thanks for the animals. Thanks for the land. Thanks for the people everywhere. Thanks a lot. Thanks for all I've got. Thanks for all I've got.
That's Priscilla Herdman, and Thanks a Lot. I'm Marlena. Thanks a lot for joining us for our second hour. Gary the Board Guy is bringing in Abdul Kumar, and I think I hear that Abdul is on the other line, so we're going to pick up, and we will bring Abdul in here in just one moment. Let me just do the housekeeping shtick again, that if you are listening to this program at any time other than 10 to 11 Eastern, 7 to 8 Pacific, or 2 to 3 on a very early UTC morning, that would be Sunday night in North America, Monday morning UTC, you are listening to a repeat, so please enjoy and put your feet up, get your favorite beverage, and enjoy the second hour. If, however, you're listening live, the telephone number to call is 866-666-7926. I'm going to introduce to you now someone whom I have only just recently met. His name is Abdul Kumar. And Abdul was born in Sierra Leone, and at age 9, he moved from Sierra Leone to the Silicon Valley of California. He is now enrolled at Morehouse College, where, upon his graduation, he will hold a degree in computer science and economics with a minor in mathematics. That boggles my mind alone. In the fall of 2007, he will begin his studies at Columbia Law School. And in the meantime, he's planning to complete a one-year program at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Abdul first came to my attention after I read a post by ACB's president, Chris Gray, in which Chris spoke of having met Abdul in Georgia and the great enthusiasm Abdul displayed for working with advocacy issues, particularly S-2686, and that's a Senate bill which has extremely important ramifications for people who are blind. So let me push the button and bring Abdul in. Hello, Abdul. Welcome to Marlena.
Thank you for having me on, Marlena.
It's lovely to have you, and you are now in Georgia, is that correct?
Yes, very hot and humid Roswell, Georgia, about 35 miles north of Atlanta.
Oh, well, we're having a cool, pleasant evening in Seattle, but I won't rub that in.
Yeah.
Now, how long have you been active in ACB?
Admittedly, not very long. Collectively, just about 3 years. When I came to the States, I was somewhat interested in joining organizations such as the American Council of the Blind, but never really could commit to the regular schedule of meetings and also events that were being held. It was not until recently that I'd really kind of expressed or you know committed to any activity to that of ACB and its affiliates. So it was not until I attended or started attending college and realizing how difficult it is to be a visually impaired and or blind individual, you know, living independently, basically trying to make a life for oneself. And it's at that point that I realized that I need to be a part of organizations such as ACB to, you know, to advocate for myself and for others like myself. So.
And it seems to me that, you know, there's always one issue that sort of centers one's focus, particularly when one is an advocate. There's one issue that really wakes you up, strikes you, and gets you going. And for you, that seems like it's S-2686. Is that accurate?
Yes, at least it is the first issue where I felt that I could do something. You know, as is often the case with individuals who are coming from a point of being marginalized and or disenfranchised, we are made to believe that there's not much that we can do about our current situation. And eventually, the way that you kind of get out of that rut is by just making the choice to do something about your current situation. And I was at a social gathering with the president of the American Council of the Blind. He and I had established a pretty good rapport quite some years prior, and so it was good to see him again. And I was at a point where I was somewhat fed up with a lot of the things that I'd been dealing with personally as a visually impaired student. And I made the decision at that point that I wanted to do something. I don't know what that was going to be. And he suggested that I help with trying to promote S-2686 bill currently in the Senate.
Well, let's do that. Let's move straight to S-2686. I've seen it referred to as the net neutrality bill. I've read pros and cons. Before we go into all of that, tell our listeners what it is. What is S-2686?
S-2686 is a Senate omnibus telecommunications bill. Omnibus, and as far as bills are concerned, means that it has everything in it but the kitchen sink. In effect, this bill has provisions for lowering telecommunications costs for soldiers in the battlefield, and so on and so forth. They're just a myriad of things and provisions that you can actually look at. The most controversial, of course, is the net neutrality provision, which ACB, frankly, it chooses to remain neutral on. The two most important provisions, and as far as we see, are ones that involve extending services or accessibility to voice over IP technology, and also descriptive video services with digital television as well as DVD programming. So that's effectively where we're at, and as far as this bill is concerned.
Okay, let's break these two areas of concern down then. You and I certainly know what VOIP is all about, but let's explain that to our listeners. What is it, and why do we as blind people care about it?
Okay, well, VO over IP, voice over IP, voice over internet protocol is what it is. It essentially is telephony, telephone technology, if you'd imagine, over the internet. It's a convergence of the telephone services that you use with the technology of the internet. Now, it's a much cheaper way to go, and along with other characteristics of the technology, so promises to revolutionize the way that we communicate with each other, you know, and will eventually render the standard technology that we use today obsolete. That's the most basic way that I can be able to explain it. And in effect, what this bill tries to do is, it in effect requires, that, the telephones, for voice over IP are accessible to those who are hard of hearing, such that, they can be able to utilize the phones with their hearing aids, and also that the service will be tied, into, relay services for the hard of hearing. But also there's a part of the provision that requires that all associated technology, with voice over internet protocols, are accessible to the blind and visually impaired.
Yeah, and that's really important. You're actually on a VOIP line right now. So
yeah.
Those folks who are hearing you are hearing you through voice over internet protocol. And I have a great provider. However, the website from my provider for this VOIP is only marginally usable by me. I can't put you on hold and go and answer another call and you know, transfer you somewhere else or do a three-way call using the website. I can't do any of those things, and not all of those things are available through star codes on the phone. So I'm paying the same amount that sighted people are paying for their VOIP, but I'm getting far less service in terms of feature richness from my VOIP.
Therein lies, a major issue that this provision will resolve. You know, clearly, as you say, that if we as visually impaired blind individuals are expected to pay, as much as everyone else to utilize this service, then it is incumbent upon providers to ensure that we have full functionality of that service. So that's what this provision asserts, requires, and it's a positive thing, I think.
And while we're talking phone stuff, let me give the number. We have opened the lines. It is 866-666-7926 to speak with Abdul Kumar here on this evening's Marlena show. Will this also extend, by the way, are there provisions that discuss directory assistance? Because that's another issue. With my particular provider anyway, I brought this up to them early on and they weren't at all willing to look at quote unquote free directory assistance, but they said they might consider allowing 5 calls a month to directory assistance, but it would be incumbent upon me as a subscriber who is blind to call them up and say, you need to take these 5 charges of $1.10 or whatever they are off my bill each month.
As the bill stands, we're not absolutely sure if such a provision is in. The bill is currently in committee. At least this is what senators tell us, and that there's so much that's being reconsidered. It may very well be that in its final form, that a provision for directory services and as far as voice over IP service may be extended. Currently, there is no guarantee of that, unfortunately.
Ah, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay, and what about the video description? This is an issue that ACB and many of us involved in ACB have been working on for years and years. And in the release that I sent out with the notice of this show, I copied a release from our director of advocacy, Dayal Muhammad, that essentially said, if we're ever going to do it, ladies and gentlemen, the time is now. What does she mean by that? What is happening with that?
Well, for many years, as you pointed out, advocacy, organizations of advocacy, including that of the American Council of the Blind, have been just enthralled in the battle to try to pass legislation that would require descriptive video services, whether on a limited or more extensible basis, to no avail, quite frankly. In 2002, a bill was passed that would require a certain amount of descriptive video in as far as public television was concerned, and I believe I'm in other arenas of programming as far as television is concerned. But about 8 months later, the Ninth Circuit overturned that piece of legislation. The rationale is far too complicated, to go into. But needless to say, while the bill did pass, it was short-lived. We just don't believe that descriptive video or legislation for descriptive video could pass on its own through the legislative process to the point of being signed by, the executive office. So this is the only opportunity, foreseeable opportunity that we have to make sure that it happens. And that's why, when Day was saying that, the time to act is now. We have 3 weeks till senators go back to Washington. They're home now trying to convince their constituents that they should vote for them again. And now is the time to try to convince those senators or tell those senators that they should go back to Congress and basically get this bill out for a vote.
Abdul, we have a call. Let's bring our caller in.
Certainly.
Hi there. You're with Abdul Kamar and Marlena. Who's this, please?
Good evening, Marlena. This is Steve Bauer.
Hello, Steve Bauer in Kansas. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine. Thunderstorms are moving in, so it's great.
Oh, well, hey, have a cold one and enjoy the show.
You bet. Abdul, a question. I am being faced with the voiceover IP technology in my employer. They have switched to a fancy phone system that is so close to being inaccessible, it is ridiculous. Is the bill going to mandate that manufacturers such as Cisco and Avaya, people like that, comply with accessibility issues?
Absolutely. That, absolutely. And I'm not sure what more I could add to that beyond, the provision in the bill regarding voice over IP will address that issue entirely, and as well as issues that that the hard of hearing may have to deal with as well. But certainly in your situation, this bill could be of great benefit to you.
Let me just share kind of a funny story. It's not funny,
certainly.
But it is. Because the soft keys on the telephone change with respect to what your phone is doing. Whether you're off the hook, they're one feature, and if you've answered a call, they're another feature, and if you put that call on hold, they're all different.
Yeah.
It is amazing. Even sighted people are doing it, but I have accidentally forwarded my calls to other places.
Oh,
and not even known it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, I have had a few occasions where I've done that with my mobile phone and have forwarded my mobile phone to other people's telephone numbers and only, you know, for my friends to call and find out that I'm not in Canada when, in fact, I'm, you know.
Well, now, let me just jump in here before you go away, Steve, and ask Abdul this question. Would it be, of course, I'm volunteering Steve, I volunteer Steve for things on a regular basis, but would it be helpful if Steve were to contact you and send you maybe a paragraph of how this bill would have an impact not only on his availability to use VOIP, but his livelihood, his job, his life? Would that be of value?
Yes, absolutely. There are two things that I'd like to recommend, really, to all of your listeners. First is to visit the ACB website. That's www.acb.org. And if you could go to the Washington Connection, and it will pretty much, Dale Muhammad, our director, you know, of the Washington Connection, effectively, it has all on there the pertinent provisions, and also in as far as being able to contact me, yes, absolutely, you can do so at Kamara, that is Kamara, at PO Box .com.
Okay.
Yeah, so Steve, I think that would be great if you found a moment when you weren't slaving for ACB Radio today.
Well, I think what we're going to be faced with very rapidly, if something isn't done, is that not only in our employment situations, but even in our homes, we're going to be faced with inaccessibility because it's just a matter of time. Now, is that time 5 years? Is it 15? Is it 25? Who knows? But it's going to be a point when all of our telephones are going to be voice over IP.
Yeah. Well, you know, conservative estimates say that there are well over 9 million blind individuals living in this country. And that's, you know, compared to 300 million, it certainly doesn't seem like a lot, but it is a significant size or number of people. And I think that if we basically were to have a situation where companies are not in any way, you know, designing technology that, you know, takes into account this population, then we have a really, really huge problem. It exacerbates the current predicament of the blind population, a 70 to 75% unemployment rate. You know, how is that to be helped if we do not have accessibility? And as far as these basic facilities, you know, whether that's telecommunications or even television, you know, some people say the television is just on the, it's just entertainment, but it informs our social connectedness, and you know, it's such a vital part of how we're able to interact with the rest of society. So to, you know, basically sit on our hands and allow these facilities to remain inaccessible would be a travesty, and I don't think that we as blind individuals should stand for that at all.
Due to the continued inaccessibility of television and its total visualness in nature, and I relate that down to a simple thing: when there are weather alerts, you hear a sounder, and then there's this nice crawl that goes across the screen. Okay, what does it mean?
Exactly.
Well, due to situations like that, I have become very anti-television. And if it wasn't for my wife just loving things like the Home and Garden Channel and the Food Network and so on and so forth, cable would be out of here totally.
Yeah. Well, and everybody knows that it is the quickest way, frankly, to disseminate information. And, you know, subsequently, it's the most expensive way as well. But it's extremely critical that we make such a facility, a public facility, accessible to, you know, well over 9 million individuals. I mean, closed captioning, you know, the argument is made that DVS, descriptive video services would be just way too expensive. And the same was said for closed captioning. And yet closed captioning is supported by 98% of television programming, to say nothing of video as well as DVD programming. So there's really no excuse to implement it, and it's high time that we do so.
All right. Well, thanks, Mr. Bauer.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye. 866-666-7926. It's about 26 minutes past the hour, give or take, depending on when you hear that, through the vagaries of the internet. And and we'll be together till just about the top of the hour with Abdul. You must tell me, is your name pronounced Kamar or Kamara?
Kamara.
Kamara. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay, because I've said it both ways, so
okay.
I want to make sure we get it right. There's nothing more insulting to your guests than calling them John when their name is Susie. I want to talk. Well, we're going to hang on. We have another call. Let's bring our caller right in. Hi there. You're with Abdul Kamara and Marlena. Who's this?
Hello, this is Stan.
Hello, Stan, the man from Oregon.
Well, you know, you brought up a very, very salient point a few moments ago when you were talking about the closed captioning, because if you can, you know, how many times do you watch or listen to television and hear closed captioning being sponsored by such and such and such and such and such and such?
Exactly.
Well, why can't you do the same thing with the technology we are talking about?
Because it isn't required, I betcha.
But the thing is, it could be a cash cow, so to speak.
Sure.
Yes. It and could be an important source of revenue for broadcasters.
Exactly.
But as is always, you know, it is generally the case that businesses are pretty much short-sighted when it comes to recognizing the benefits of extending their services to the disabled and accommodating them accordingly. So,
believe me, I know that for sure, because we've been having our little wars, as you know, Marlena can attest from my previous conversations with her.
Absolutely.
But I think that it would be very interesting to follow this, and I wish you the best of luck in your endeavor.
Well, now, Stan, I'm not going to let you off the hook.
Okay.
You're not going to just hang up and say, golly, what a nice job you're doing and good luck.
Right.
I want to hear a commitment from you. Are you going to contact your Oregon senators?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Come on, let's hear it a little stronger now.
Yeah, I would endeavor to do that. You know, the thing is, I have a lot of things, but we're going to try to do that. We will go.
Well, before we finish up here tonight, and this will also give Abdul some space to think about it, I'm going to ask Abdul to kind of run down a list of talking points that we might just highlight to our senators.
Oh,
so stay tuned for that. I wouldn't ask you to do something and not try to give you the tools with which to do it, but also you can go to the acb.org Washington Connection, and look at the things there. But we'll go through kind of some talking points that Abdul might suggest in a short email or phone call. So,
and as usual, you're having a great program.
Well, you're just wonderful, and the check will be in the mail next week for those kind words.
Talk to you later.
All right. Bye. Thanks a lot, Stan. Bye-bye. 866-666-7926. You got to pay him well, you know what I mean?
Abdul? Absolutely.
Or else they go away, you know what I'm saying? Why is it that closed captioning is so ubiquitous and descriptive video seems to be such an issue? Why?
Well, I think that it is primarily because there's this overall perception that descriptive video is would be a far more expensive endeavor. Which, in fact, we've seen no real evidence that it would be. You know, I think also it's because there's this general perception that its implementation would be much more complicated, and that you know, establishing standards for its implementation would be you know, just far too complicated. And again, there's no real evidence of that thus far. You know, when it's been implemented on public television, you know, from time to time, it seems to work effectively. So part of it also is that there's been no real organized effort to have descriptive video services. The blind community is unfortunately rather fragmented on this issue. You know, as far as we understand, the National Federation of Blind does not really have a position on this matter, and to my knowledge, it's not really assisting in our endeavors. So, so it's part of the reason we are fragmented on this. There's no real, you know, concerted effort, at least not to the degree of the deaf community, in making sure that closed captioning happened.
That's unfortunate.
It is.
What does the bill talk at all about? And, you know, I'm sure we'll get a call about this, so I'm just going to bring the question out onto the table. Whenever we talk about advocating for descriptive video, inevitably someone speaks up, rightfully so, and says, well, there's no point in having descriptive video if I can't get to the video description on my television. Now, before you answer that, we have a call, so I'll give you some time to cogitate on that, and we'll bring
certainly
in the caller. Hi there, you're with Abdul Kamar and Marlena. Who's this?
Hey, Marlena, it's Dale Campbell.
Hey, Dale Campbell, how are you?
Man, I am doing great.
All right. What do we?
I just wanted to ask.
I love that enthusiasm.
What is the what is the procedure now that this bill is in committee? Committee will, and the Senate has it been taken to the House? Has the House had it yet as well?
Well, yes, the House has had it. You know, they've bounced it around through their own process, and now the Senate has it. The Senate, you know, it went through their own process of kind of adding amendments, and some amendments were rejected. It's my understanding that McCain and another senator have a proposed amendment that would address the net neutrality component. We haven't heard much about that. But in as far as we understand, the bill is really at its final stage in as far as revisions are concerned. So,
Have you gotten any feedback from other senators that are out of committee on what they feel this is, if it's going to float or if it's going to die?
Well, it's an election year for about a third of the Senate, and so a lot of them don't want to be on record about this bill. It's extremely controversial from the net neutrality element of it. So, you know, I'm just every other component. I mean, if you look at much of the provisions of S-2686, it's hard to disagree that, you know, those provisions are great. You know, who wants to disagree with, you know, lowering the cost of, you know, calling home from Iraq? You know, who wants to, you know, but when you look at net neutrality, you have organizations like Google, Microsoft, you know, and so on against it. And then you have, you know, the bells for it. So those
are huge. You've got big money on both sides pulling it both ways.
Exactly. And so you don't, as a senator, it would be politically risky and costly to assume a position on it. That's not to say that we're not trying to press them on the issue. And in fact, I've called both of my senators, and you know, I've asked them, you know, what's your view on this? And they will say, well, it's in committee. And I'll tell them, well, actually, you know, you're just trying to blow me off, because really it's toward its end, and I don't think you're going to do much with it. So, you know, what's it going to be? You know, I want you to support this because it helps me and it helps 9 million other blind individuals.
Exactly.
To say nothing of the more than 51 million disabled individuals that live in this country. So
yeah, well, and that's my point too. I mean, I lost my sight 10 years ago, and I mean, I hit the street raising Cain as well about just little issues and doing what we can all do in our own neighborhoods. But in this case, I mean, as people get older, you know, that number is going to continue to increase, and you know, it's like, you know, it's the money thing. We just need to look down the road and see, you know, I mean, there's a cash prize at the end, and not only a cash prize, there's just a prize at the end for everybody.
Absolutely.
It's a total win-win situation.
And, well, and this is what we typically find as well, is that facilities that are designed, you know, to integrate the disabled into the rest of mainstream society generally benefits the mainstream. You know, talk about ramps, you know, on sidewalks, you know, expecting mothers use those, you know, and certainly with strollers and so on and so forth. It's not just for people using wheelchairs. You know, we find that with text-to-speech technology, yes, where generally it is used by the blind and visually impaired, we find that text-to-speech technology is being used in GPS units in cars and so on and so forth. So, you know, the more that we support, you know, accessibility on just a general scale and as far as bringing disabled individuals to the mainstream, the more the mainstream benefits.
Exactly.
In very indirect ways, but, you know, they certainly
do.
Yeah,
I mean, so do we indirectly. I mean, you know, with Blind My Smart and the Mousehole Scholarship, that was my big selfish reason, is providing, you know, scholarships for these kids so they can get educated, get into the mainstream. And, you know, the more blind individuals that are in the mainstream, I mean, just think if our unemployment rate was around 10 or 15%. You know, how many more blind individuals would be in the workplace, and that many companies would be educated and come around to, well, our way of thinking.
Yeah.
You know, to make a, you know, just whack them in the head with a cane until they keep coming around our way of thinking.
That's what you do in Texas, right,
yeah.
Dale?
Yeah, that's right. You carry a big cane down here to him.
Exactly. Walk softly and carry a big cane.
That's right, or a dog with big teeth. Well,
yeah,
Dale,
right.
I encourage you and ask you to make a commitment to contact your senators when the show is through.
I would like to challenge every person listening to this program
to start making
some phone calls, and let's start shaking some bushes.
I love this guy.
There's 9 million of us, and, you know, I mean, here in the Houston area, if every blind person resident in the Houston area were to go out and vote, we could sway an election.
That's right.
Because
absolutely.
I think we total more than the total number of people that go out and vote anyway.
There you go.
Absolutely.
There you go.
But then we got to get somebody, you know, to make sure they're voting the right way too, you know.
Yeah. One step at a time.
Another issue.
Oh, you're full of issues, Dale Campbell.
All right. Well, hey, man, keep up the good work, and yeah, everybody, please get in touch with your senators. Make those phone calls, and let's put some pressure on them from our side of the coin.
All right, Mr. Cooking in the Dark.
Right. Anything else, we'll bring them over and make them eat. Well, no, we don't want to do that.
We can make that Lynchburg lemonade you talked about a few weeks ago. I'll tell you about that one day. Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Lemonade. I love lemonade.
All right. Thanks, Dale. Bye-bye. And you can hear Dale's show every week on ACB Radio. It's called Cooking in the Dark, so check it out. Okay, back to my question, Abdul, about access to the accessible service on the TV. Is there any discussion about the equipment in the bill?
There is a woman by the name of Jennifer Simpson, and I am remiss in forgetting what organization she works with, but you can certainly look that up on acb.org. There is a push toward ensuring that legacy, televisions, so old televisions, are able to access descriptive video. 2009, February 17th of 2009, analog broadcasting will be phased out in favor of digital broadcasting of television. And, no one is necessarily just going to be tossing out their analog TVs, you know, right there on the spot. There will have to be some point of transition. And so, during that time, a lot of people will be using, a converter box that will convert the digital signals into analog signals. There is a push toward making sure that those boxes are able to also translate and convey descriptive video, services as well.
Hmm. Yeah, it's pretty important, because to have it is one thing, but seemingly to access it. Now, for example, we have, you know, Gary the board guy and I, we're pretty geeky people, and we're old, but we're geeky, you know. and so we have this wild setup in the living room, but honestly, if Gary hadn't gone through and programmed for me various buttons on the remote control, I wouldn't be able to get what little is accessible to me now. It's all menus. There's no beeps. There's no sounds. You don't know if you've done anything. And so this is a question that I hear all of the time as I advocate for involvement in this arena. Blind people will justifiably say to me, don't you think we ought to worry first about how we're going to access it? So I'm glad to hear that there is some thought to that. Let's talk a bit now about strategy. Who do we want to contact, and by when do we want to contact them?
Okay. Well, right now happens to be a pretty good time to contact your senator. Listeners, tomorrow's Monday, and it's a whole new day, and chances are that your senators are home because Congress is out on a break, and so a lot of senators are kind of coming home and bringing home the political bacon, to kind of show to the constituents, say, well, hey, I was out there and I did this for you, so vote for me. And now's the time to basically tell them, well, actually, you're not done yet. There's a bill out there, and it's important to how I live my life and how I connect with the rest of society. And I want you to make sure that it comes out for a vote. And not only that, I want you to vote yes for it. So, yes, call your senators. Call their offices. Fax them. Request a meeting if you can. Whatever you can do in order to kind of convey your point of view, do so. You spoke of talking points, and there are quite a few that we have. We try not to really relegate a lot of this to just mere talking points, because we really want people to convey what having descriptive video means for them and what it means to have an accessible telecommunications system. I think that talking points is a very narrow way of being able to convey that. I think that if you speak from the heart and convey to your senators why this is important to you, I think that would be far more effective. But if that doesn't work, say, effectively that, there are 9 million blind individuals living in this country, who need accessible facilities. Otherwise, in effect, to do otherwise would be to shut them out. And so that's what I would say. And as far as the overall ACB strategy, well, we are doing some letter writing of our own. We are calling senators left and right. I know that the president is certainly that's the president of the American Council is calling a lot of senators, and also presidents of affiliates to make sure that things are rolling. We are trying to court as much support from organizations like the American Foundation Fighting Blindness, the American Library Association, so on and so forth, to try to drum up support and to show senators that it's just not a few people who are interested in this. It's quite a bit more.
If the issue of net neutrality is raised, how should people respond to that?
Well, I doubt truly that a senator will bring that up. But, I think on the matter, it's such a complicated issue that one should just remain neutral on it. And, if you're asked what your position is on it, just basically reply that it's a complicated issue. It is one that involves a lot of heavy players. There's a lot of rhetoric surrounding, the provision, and that it is truly hard to say what the real outcome would be if it were or were not passed. So, the key is to remain neutral on this issue. And, it sounds like a non-committal response, but it is true. It is extremely complicated. I've read the provisions on net neutrality, and I'm an avid, technologist, and even I just, shake my head.
Yeah.
So, you know, on this matter, I would definitely recommend for you and your listeners to just remain neutral on that matter and just try to push the more positive, non-controversial parts of the bill. I mean, much of the bill is non-controversial. It's not in any way controversial.
Well, and I raise that question to lead me into the next question. But before I go there, let me just say that I think that's a fine answer. I think that one mistake that certainly I in lives gone by and probably in this one will make again, but certainly have made in my past, is trying to answer everything they ask, trying to have an answer. Well, you don't have to. If you are neutral on a position, if that is not where your deep concern lies, it's so much better to say that this is an area where we are neutral. However, here are the areas of our concern. And that leads me to my next question. As an advocate over the years, I've often been frustrated at my inability to convey to others around me not only the need and the importance to get involved, talk to your senator, to your congressman, to whomever, but the ease of it. I think many folks are afraid, and many folks therefore don't do it because they feel like, oh, well, you know, Abdul can do it, or Marlena can do it, or Dale can do it. You know, they can all speak so much better than I can. Talk to me a little bit about, if you've never done it and you want to get into this, what is it like? What happens?
Well, I'll tell you what happened with me and President Chris Gray. We were sitting down having a drink along with about 10 other people. And I was walking around the table greeting everyone. Came across him, and I basically told him that I wanted to do something. That's as simple as it gets, really. Whatever you're interested in, whether it's a campaign, an issue, find an organization supporting that, and join. I don't think that you're in any way likely to be turned away for volunteering your services. Chris was quite surprised, and you know, he later on told me that it's quite amazing that, you know, there not a lot of people come up to him and volunteer their time in helping in any kind of kind of pursuits of ACB. Just volunteer your time and your services to something that you really care about, and you need not be a leader in that cause, but anything that you can do, whether that's stuffing envelopes or writing letters or, you know, just whatever, can be invaluable.
And then when I contact my senator, am I going to actually talk to my senator, or am I going to, what's going to happen?
Most likely not. Senators Barbara Boxer and Feinstein, for example, have a constituents of about 40 million Californians. So I'm inclined to believe that they aren't as likely to to make time to speak to all of those individuals who may have complaints. So instead, who you're likely to speak more to is their aide, or their aides rather. So whether that's in California or Washington D.C. But usually you can call their office and request that you speak with a Senate aide who may specialize in legislation regarding telecommunications or disability rights or whatnot. And so you can be able to speak to either one of those individuals and convey your point of view.
And on the telephone call, how do I conduct myself? Should I be prepared to kind of elaborate what I'm calling about and why I want the senator to support it? And should I ask them to call me back or write me and tell me what the senator did?
Absolutely. Yes, a more pointed approach in the beginning would be good. State your position. State who you are, that you're a constituent of that state, and that you know why you're calling, that you're supporting the bill, allow the individual that you're speaking with to kind of have you elaborate on your position. And, you know, some may be interested, and if they do not seem to convey the necessary level of interest, then you can certainly press on, you know, and try to convince them that, you know, they should listen. You know, try to be cordial and respectful, but you can certainly be forceful. You know, these are, public servants. They're there to serve your needs. And in the final analysis, you know, you should not in any way shy away from conveying your point of view to them.
And then finally, in terms of what we want to ask them to do, let's really hone in on that. So I've got
Absolutely.
My senator on the phone, and I've gone through, you know, the telecommunications piece. My job is in jeopardy. The descriptive video piece. We had a tornado, and I didn't know it. And you know, I mean, I'm being a little silly here, but we've gone through all of the whereases and why fors. Now, what do I want specifically to ask them to do?
Tell them to vote for the bill. Tell them that it is crucial that they vote for the bill. Crucial to a way of life. Crucial to all Americans. And I think that's effectively what you try to convey to your senators. I don't think that there should be any kind of a diplomatic language, you know, beyond that. You know, you have to convey why this is important to you. And it's important to every blind individual that we pass this piece of legislation. But urge your senator to vote for this bill. What's required really is 60 votes for the bill to make sure, you know, to ensure that there are no sorry, I can't talk today. Filibusters, mm-hmm. or, you know, procedures to, mm-hmm. to block it and to prevent it from being signed. And so that's where we're at. So, senators need to know that, you know, that they need to take a position on this. They cannot pussyfoot on it anymore. And, so that they should vote for the bill.
The bill is in committee now, is that right?
Yes.
Can it die there in committee and never come out?
Yes, it can die there if senators are not. We've spoken, we had some correspondence with Senator Bill Frist, and he in effect said, "Look, if there are not 60 votes, you know, for this bill, it will not get passed."
So
this,
do we
line? So.
So do we need to communicate to our senators then that in addition to voting for the bill, that they need to communicate the need to get the bill out of committee?
Well, it takes only a few to get it out of committee, but mm-hmm. you know, to get it out of committee, there needs to be some assurance that it will basically make it through. And so, yes, I mean, part of doing that is just pressing your senator, you know, to take a position on this bill, and not only that, but to take the right one, which is to vote for mm-hmm. it. More people that can do that, then the more that we have an assurance for 60 votes, and the more that those who are kind of part of the process of moving this bill along will feel confident in kind of taking it out for a vote. Or bringing it on the floor for a vote, rather.
And here's a two-part question that I think we want to make sure our listeners know, and I'm certainly curious about. The first part is, in which committee is the bill? And secondly, do we have any idea where we are in terms of numbers with support of the bill?
It is a Commerce Committee. And I'm sorry, I did not get the second question.
Do we have any idea where we are in terms of support for numbers?
It's been estimated at 52 or 53.
Oh, boy.
So just about 7 short of making it filibuster-proof. But, you know, there's currently a sponsor and a co-sponsor for the bill. So, and as far as having support on record, we have only two on record.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is, you know, through informal conversations, you know, off the record assurances.
Are there any, we have listeners from all over the United States and certainly all around the world, but unfortunately worldwide listeners, we need your inherent support, but our senators probably aren't going to be too interested in what you think if you're in the UK. However, we as blind people need you, so please stick with us on this issue. But are there any particular areas of the United States where you want to say to listeners, we need you, your senators are not coming on board? Is there any geographic area that we should reach out to?
Well, not specifically. You know, we are indeed trying to establish contacts in many states. It's a battle everywhere. To try to get senators to take a position on this matter. The state of Illinois, it's my understanding that both senators are concerned, again, about the net neutrality provision, and as a result, you know, have not really taken a firm position, you know, in favor of 2686. So, and you can find, you know, such a case in many other states. You know, the final analysis is that, you know, everybody needs to call their senators. No one, except for two senators, but no one else is on the record as supporting this bill. You know, it's informal conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So we need, you know, constituents. We need people to call senators and make sure that they, you know, communicate that
mm-hmm.
this is important and that it needs to pass.
Well, I one last quick question before I make my closing statement here. Who are the two senators on record?
Certainly Senator Stevens of Arkansas and I believe a Republican senator of Hawaii. I forgot his name.
Ah, okay, great.
But yes, yeah.
Great, great.
Those two individuals, yes.
If people would like to get hold of you to discuss this further or get some more information from you in terms of advocacy strategies, how could they do that?
Certainly. Again, they can get a hold of me via email, which is Kamara, K-A-M-A-R-A, at pobox.com. That's P-O-B-O-X.com. You can certainly, you know, check out the ACB website, where you can be able to get in touch with the Director of Legislative Affairs, the President, you know, if ACB is certainly interested in, you know, talking to individuals who are willing
Great.
To help in this endeavor. So, the three of us, you know, certainly can be contacted. And you know, it's an entire family over there of people who are, you know, working very hard to make sure that this thing passes. So.
Well, Abdul, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to, we're probably going to run over time here, but I'm going to issue a challenge to each and every one of my listeners. For you to contact your senators, and when you have done that, when you have contacted them, drop me an email to Marlena, M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org. I want you to flood my inbox. Abdul, thank you so much. We'll be back again next week with another Marlena program. We're just about out of time. So have a safe week and join us next week for the next Marlena.
Thank you, Marlena.
I'm Marlena. And this is the music of Lee Ritenour, a little dolphin dreamin' as we go out for this week.